Khan's knife is the only thing moving as it spins around and around. Isadora considers mourning, then me. It's clear she doesn't believe a word I've said. "Keep him," she says, "for now. One day, though, I will claim him." I can almost feel the anger pulsing through mourning. I try to make my feet move, to say the right thing to calm her down, but everything feels numb. Omar crosses the room in two strides. He sets his massive hand on Morning's shoulder to stop her from doing something she'll regret. The whole room feels like it's ready to explode when Kit comes barreling in from the opposite hallway. "Incoming!" he shouts. "Put on your game faces. The Adamite emissaries have arrived. This is gonna be one of history's..." It takes him 2 seconds to pick up on the energy of the room. He holds both hands up in an innocent gesture. "But take your time or whatever. History can wait. I'll be outside." He ducks through the entryway, and it's like the ticking bomb stops at the very last second. Morning turns, angrily shrugging Omar away. Everyone moves like startled birds, preparing to go outside. But the attention from Morning and Isadora pins me in place. Isadora's eyes are dark with promise. Mornings are lost somewhere between fury and fear. Morning takes a deep, calming breath and says, "I'll take point. We need this to go well."
"Then with all due respect," Parvin cuts in, "you're not the right person. Not right now. You can take back the lead when you've cooled off."
Morning starts to snap something, but realizes she's just proving Parvin right.
"Fine," she says. "Parvin takes point."
Our new leader adjusts her glasses and slides calmly forward.
"Come on," she says. "Let's go meet an alien species."
There's an awkward second as the group calibrates to their new commander. Some move toward the entryway. Ida is whispering furiously with Isadora. Holly turns a lock of red hair around one finger, listening to their argument, always so quiet. Katsu comes forward and slaps my back.
"Who's having fun?"
Morning cuts in my direction. She takes her place at my side, grinding her teeth, as the entire group files outside after Parvin. Isadora follows, chin raised. Morning broods beside me. I've never seen her this way. I don't know how to calm her down.
"So I catch heat for saving Rothi's life," I point out. "But Ida wasn't exactly shooting daggers at Alex over Locke. Isn't that what Alex being here means? That he killed Locke?"
Morning takes a steadying breath.
"Ida doesn't know which room Locke was in. She doesn't know who killed him. I'll make sure Anton and Jamie keep their mouths shut. It's hard enough keeping one of you alive. We don't need to throw another target on Alex's back."
There's a second where we just stand there, breathing in the unfairness of it all. Babel's sins are starting to count against us.
He's alive. Rothi's alive. We could ask Babel for proof.
"If he's actually alive," she says,
"how do you know Babel didn't just kill him after you left him there?"
The question catches me off guard. I realize she's right. I really have no clue.
"I don't know what to do,"
she admits.
"If she really decides to come for you, I can't just hurt her, Emmett. Not with a baby. I don't know what to do."
There's an excited shout from outside.
"You've got my back, I've got your back. That's enough for now."
She shakes her head, like that's too simple, like she needs to have a real plan.
"My big takeaway from all of this, though, is that you clearly like me a lot."
She smacks my arm.
Lurch.
Outside, the entire group waits in a line. I lead Morning carefully to the opposite side of where Isadora is standing. Parvin's waiting at center, a few steps ahead of us. I glance over at Morning and can tell she's still hot with it all.
"Didn't mean to get you demoted."
She forces a smile.
"Parvin will do fine."
Dust swirls on the distant plain. Beneath the clouds, four black spheres speed in our direction. Electrical charges crackle between them,
flashing every few seconds like horizontal lightning. They're still a few thousand meters away, but covering ground quickly.
Hey, Morning whispers. What was my guess? The second day after dawn?
I look up at the sky and realize she was spot the hell on.
Not bad.
She raises an eyebrow.
I'll collect my prize later.
My eyes flick back to the approaching spheres. All four begin to unwind, black shards peeling open like the petals of a flower. Each vessel gapes open wide enough for their riders to come walking right out onto the plain. I can hear Azima laughing. Anton glances down the line.
What's so funny?
I just realized my breath smells like a nightmare, she says.
Anyone have gum?
The joke cuts straight through the tension. We all laugh, because the thought is so absurd. Forget that this might be the most important moment in human history in our lives. The four figures continue their approach. From a distance, they look like men, but we know they're not.
Adamites,
Jazzy says farther down the line.
This is actually happening, y'all.
Parvin glances back at us.
Shoulder to shoulder.
Mostly Genesis 12 members repeat the phrase. We all watch as the black spheres twist through the air. They reform around the approaching party, dressing each Adamite in dark capes with walking sticks or armor. It's not hard to see how effortlessly they're manipulating the Nyxia. It's quite an opening performance. I can't stop my mind from flashing back to the first video that Babel showed us. The welcoming parties of our two species. I remember the obscuring flashes of black, the dismembered marines. I can hear the tortured Adamite that Kaya and I found imprisoned in the belly of the ship, too. The pulse of anger that shouldered forward before he killed her. We're here again, on the edge of something that's so much bigger than ourselves. We all take our places. We try to stand tall.
No pressure, Parvin,
Katsu calls.
Just our lives hanging in the balance.
I was captain of the debate team,
Parvin answers.
This'll be a walk in the park.
The Adamites are 100 meters away. I realize how little we know about them. Only what Babel's told us, and that's never been much. All we have in this moment is the hope that Babel didn't lie about this too. I imagine Defoe watching the scene unfold through some camera on the outskirts of Foundry. Does he know what is about to happen? Do any of them? The Adamites have a leader too. He strides ahead of the others, chin held high. I guess some things are just universal. All of them look well-dressed in their tight-fitting fabrics. Sunlight shimmers off silver buttons and decorative rings. It's clear they've come in their finest. Only one of the four wears a weapon on his hip. I'm not stupid enough to think that makes him the dangerous one. All of them are dangerous. The first Adamite we encountered was bound hand and foot to a wall, and he still killed Kaya. The last thing I notice is that all four of them are male. I want to jump to a few conclusions about that, but the sample size is too small. I take a steadying breath as they come to a stop just 20 meters away.
Welcome, Genesis, the leader says. May we speak?
I'm surprised to hear them call us by that name. It's the way I've started thinking about us, almost a way to distinguish us from Babel. Parvin takes a decisive step forward.
We would be honored.
His face breaks into a wide smile. It's unashamed delight. He looks at the others, gesturing excitedly, and they look recklessly happy. One of them gives a nervous laugh. We are welcome. We are wanted and long expected. The emotion that echoes through each face is so powerful that it's almost like we're watching actors in a play. Their leader begins.
I am Theseus of the First Ring, the appointed spokesman of the Daughters. I speak on behalf of all Seven Set.
He allows us time to process, but the words don't mean much. I snagged his name and his title, and that's it. He's the messenger.
May my brothers introduce themselves?
Parvin nods.
Please do.
Aside from Thesis, the Atomites are all barrel-chested. I can see lines of muscle beneath every stretch of fabric. Their eyes are wide-set, too. Full of color. But not all the paintings are as striking as the rest. One looks like he has a galaxy of colors implanted in his irises. Another stares back mud pits. Their skin so tan that it verges on gold. Each wears his hair high and swept away from his forehead. They've buzzed the sides so that their sweeps look dramatic and startling. As the first one steps forward, I notice the Nixian implants. They all have shards of it grafted into their skin. My mind flashes back to the captive aboard Genesis 11. I can picture the Nixia set into his knees and elbows. Each Atomite wears his implant in a different place.
I'm Bekwe of the Seventh Ring.
He looks younger than the others. His hair is pulled into a top knot, and Nixian implants cover each of his knuckles. Not someone I'd like to get in a fight with.
I am Bale of the Third Ring.
He's the one with eyes that look like captured galaxies. Nixian implants are set into each temple.
It is an honor.
The final Atomite has a voice so soft that we all lean forward to hear him. Nixian stones are planted into the skin around one mud-colored eye, circling in the shape of a bullseye. It's hard to think about anything but how badass it looks.
And I am Speaker of the Second Ring, the Daughter's Sword.
Again, not sure what that means, but it sounds as badass as he looks. Their leader, Thesis, steps forward again. I notice he's the least warrior-like. It has me wondering what the power structures are in their world. Maybe he's their version of a politician or something.
Well met, he says. Now please, tell us why you are here.
I see Parvin's shoulders go rigid. The question is direct, almost rude, but they're different people with different customs. Parvin looks like she's tracing back through the handful of details Babel gave us about the Atomites during our studies. I try to remind myself that in their eyes, we're visitors from a foreign planet. Maybe even hostile visitors, considering all they have to measure us by is Babel. Parvin recovers quickly.
We've come to Eden by your invitation. We are emissaries, a bridge between our people and yours.
She holds up a piece of Nixia.
And we've been asked to mine this substance. Our employers expect us to work on their behalf.
It's hard to read all the reactions, and they're subtle as hell. Bekwe's fist tightens before he smiles. Bale and Speaker exchange delighted nods. I watch and wait, and let out a breath when Thesis responds with enthusiasm.
We are honored, though may I make a slight correction?
Of course, Parvin replies.
You called our world Eden. We've heard Babel representatives call our home by that name. But you cannot be wise if you do not call things by their right names. Do you agree?
I do agree. He gestures up to the sky, like the word is written there.
Our relationship to the two moons dictates our identity. The larger moon is Magnus. For now, that means that our world is known as Magnia. But the system's rotations will bring the smaller moon, Glacius, closer in a few years. When that happens, we will call our world Glacia. In another 50 years from then, we'll call ourselves Magnia again. And so on, and so on.
Parvin nods.
Magnus and Glacius. They sound beautiful.
Thesis smiles wider, but for the first time, it looks forced.
We are honored to fulfill this contract. Babel has delivered you to our world as agreed, and your presence will be a brightness to our people.
To see children again.
To have you in our homes and walking through our streets, That will bring back a lost kind of paradise. All of you are here to restore a world our people have forgotten.
For the first time, I feel the weight on this side of the equation. I've always understood Babel's reasons. More money, more Nixia, more power. That makes all the sense in the world. But I never thought about what the Atomites got out of the deal. It always seemed like we were an entertaining sideshow. A permission granted to Babel so the Atomites could witness a miracle they've lost. For the first time, it feels like more than that. Theseus and the others are looking at us like we've come to save them. I file it away, under D, for dig deeper.
And in exchange, Theseus continues, you will have 21 days to work, as Babel has requested, before your visit to Sevenset, and another 100 days after your visit. Mine the substance. Take it with you. It will not hurt us to see some of it go. For now, I will leave you these three escorts, Speaker, Bali, and Bekwe. We would not risk your lives by leaving you unattended. As you may know, Magnia is not always a friendly world.
The Atomites exchange grins at that. Theseus says,
Grimgarden is our safest continent. Assigned hunting parties worked to make this section of our world even safer prior to your arrival. We know, however, that your kind are not familiar with the ways of our creatures. I offer these escorts to see you safely through your tasks and eventually lead you to Sevenset's gates. Not only are these three of our most respected warriors, but they've been trained in our histories as well. As you travel through Grimgarden, they will tell you our stories, give you a deeper understanding of our people. Is this suitable?
All three of our offered guardians wait with trembling excitement. Their faces light up with smiles that are so wide they almost look fake. Again, I'm left feeling strange about it all. We mean even more to them than we thought we did. That could be very good, or very bad. Parvin is quick to accept their offer, because what else can she say? These were Babel's terms. This is Babel's arrangement. Reject the offer, and we risk offending the welcoming party. And our main plan is to play nice, mind Nixia, keep our eyes open. Eventually, we'll have to fight back against Babel. It's not hard to see that the Atomites might be our best possible ally.
Good, Theseus says. I do not doubt that Babel would like you to take advantage of every hour. I will await your presence in Sevenset. I leave these escorts at your disposal. We hope that this will be the first step in a long and meaningful partnership.
Parvin reaches out her hand. The gesture has me leaning in to get a better look. Do the Atomites even shake hands? Theseus considers the handshake, but holds out both of his hands instead, bunching them into fists. He sets them both a few centimeters apart.
This is our way, he explains. One fist for each moon.
Parvin reaches out and bumps her fists into his. We all watch as Theseus crosses one hand under the other and holds the fists out again, twisted now.
And the second symbolizes a permanent agreement. One for both worlds, no matter how the moons might change. It's a promise between peoples.
Parvin daps him up again, and the entire group lets out a held breath. Our negotiations have already gone about 100 times better than anything Babel has managed in the last 2 decades. All three of our guardians come smiling forward. We watch Theseus summon the Nixia from his shoulders and bracelets. The material blooms out and encircles him. Up close, the vehicle looks about the size of a motorcycle. I spy a final satisfied look on the emissary's face before Nixia swallows him whole. We watch him launch into motion and pick up speed before he's reduced to a black speck on the distant plain. Speaker turns to us.
Now, shall we teach you the ways of our people?
Chapter 5.
The Ways of Our People, Emmett Atwater. It takes Kid about 2 seconds to remind us that Babel's shadow hangs over everything. He steps out front so he's nice and visible, before lifting both hands to get everyone's attention.
Time to start digging,
he announces.
I'm going to have the trucks pull around, one for each unit. The locations of your assigned mines are on the map. You'll mine until an hour before sundown, then head back here. Don't stay out there at night, okay? I'll let you all decide which escort will go with which crew.
Rolling back one sleeve, Kit brings up the digital interface that controls Foundry. There's a distant rumble of gates opening and engines starting up. Morning signals for our crew to join us off to one side. As the other groups form ranks, I catch another glimpse of Isadora. She's clenching her jaw so hard it looks like it's made of steel. I try to shake off the bad vibes and focus on the task ahead. Bally ends up joining Katsu's crew. I'm not surprised to see that Katsu somehow already has the Atomite shaking with laughter. And Beckway's in an animated conversation with Parvin, which leaves us Speaker. We introduce ourselves, and he repeats each of our names, rolling syllables over his tongue and smiling at the way they sound. It's like he's discovered fire or snow for the first time. But our first exchange gets swallowed by the sound of the approaching trucks. Three pristine mining vehicles come rolling out of underground storage. It's a little overwhelming to remember that this is the first time we've ever actually seen them in person. Everything on Genesis 11 was a simulation. Kit directs the trucks in a straight line, so they're ready to be boarded and taken out to the mining sites. Azima sets a dark hand on the nearest wheel. It has her entire forearm vibrating. She turns back, eyes bright above her mask.
It's real, she shouts. I call riding in the back.
Anton slides quietly between Morning and me. He wraps an arm around our shoulders and lowers his voice to a whisper.
Not meaning to break up the lovely couple, but I was wondering if I might ride up front with Morning. I have a few things I'd like to discuss.
Couple? Morning asks, smiling. I must have missed all those times Emmett took me out to dinner on the Tower space station. I throw her a raised eyebrow.
Let me check out a few Atomite restaurants on Yelp and get back to you, all right?
She laughs at that before nodding.
Be careful back there.
Speaker waits awkwardly off to the side. I nod back to Morning before walking over to join him. Let's ride in the back, Speaker. You can give me the unofficial tour. The truck is broken up into three parts. Morning and Anton climb into the driver's hatch and sit down in front of an intricate nest of high-tech panels and switches. There's the bird-like drill squatting behind it, and the open loading bed bringing up the rear. We all climb up, carefully skirting the miniature rover that's roosting there. A series of black straps runs along the base of the loading bed. I demonstrate putting my feet in so that Speaker gets the idea. The last thing we need is for Morning to hit a bump and send our escort flying out of the truck. Wouldn't exactly be the most diplomatic beginning. Longway sits in the driver's seat of the truck, right behind us. Azima blows him a kiss, and he shakes his head, blushing. Jamie sits beside her, all patched up, the blood cleaned from his uniform. When Kit gives the signal, the whole truck heaves back into motion. Speaker's eyes are quick to take in everything we're doing. We stand together like farmhands, green hills rolling by, everything burned gold by the rising sun. Hey, Speaker. So, what can you tell us about your people? We're not exactly well-versed in Atomite culture. Babel only had so much to pass on to us. He smiles at me.
Your first lesson will be easy. We are not called Atomites.
I stare at him for a second.
But that's what Babel has always told you.
He nods knowingly.
It is an odd habit of theirs, naming what already has a name. We have overlooked it for decades, but if you truly want to know us, then we should begin with a proper foundation. Our people are known as the Imago.
Imago? It's not hard to link the name back to Magnia and Magnus. It's a strong-sounding name. and a long look at Speaker has me feeling it's a far better fit. It doesn't surprise me that Babel's out here playing the role of colonizer, slapping labels on the originals and pretending they created it all in the first place. It's pretty standard procedure for folks like them. I like that. The imago. I trace back through our grand introduction, searching for another topic. And you're from the second ring, right? He smiles politely.
Yes, Emmett.
Is where you're from important? You all said it in your introductions.
Yes. I live on the second ring. It identifies me to other imago and to you. It is a way of showing how I am esteemed by my people.
I nod. So the second ring is good? Speaker's brown eyes narrow playfully.
It is better than the third.
But worse than the first, Jamie guesses. And there are seven total rings. The farther out, the lower the status? I ask.
For the most part, Speaker answers. The outer rings usually have less esteem than the inner rings, with the seventh as an exception. It borders the continents and acts as a barrier against the dangers of our world. Those who live on the seventh are often warriors of great standing. Some believe their status is above the second and below the first, but it's not a universally accepted view.
On the ship, we studied maps and landscapes and fuzzy satellite photographs, but every word from Speaker is a new lesson on the Adamite, no, the Imago people. Babel didn't teach us about a ranking system, or a ring and seven set dedicated to the military. Either they didn't know, or they didn't want us to know. I can't help imagining my neighborhood in Detroit as the sixth ring, with a little bit of the seventh thrown in. We might be the lowest of the low, but we're fighters, too. Always have been. I find myself eyeing the Nixian bullseye grafted in a spiral around Speaker's eye. I noticed your markings, I say, gesturing to them. What are they? His fingers trace over the spot idly, like he's forgotten it's there.
We have them implanted at birth. They are a reminder of all who have come before us.
A thousand questions come to mind, but I don't ask any of them. He says the words with such respect that I feel it'd be rude to ask more, like interviewing someone at a funeral. Instead, I lean back and watch clouds blot out the sun. Magnia. It's a beautiful world. I don't have to close my eyes for it to feel a little like home, a little like Earth. We drive in silence for a while before Speaker points west. The trees at the edge of the forest shake and bend. I can just make out flashes of bronze moving from branch to branch. Clippers, right? I ask. We saw a pack of them last night.
They are one of a select number of remaining pack species in our world.
Azima perks up at that.
Strange. Most of the animals in our world work in packs.
Our scientists think once it was so, Speaker admits. The theory is that originally there was only a single moon in the sky. Fossil records show that pack species dominated that era. But the creation of our second moon changed how those systems functioned.
The words scientist and theory drum through me. Listening to Speaker is forcing me to dismiss the image Babel gave us of them. I always pictured a tribe of wanderers, powerful and primitive people. I expected strange religions or bizarre clothing. Speaker is offering us a glimpse of more.
The moons? Azima asks curiously. The moons change the animals?
Speaker gestures up. Overnight, both moons have shifted again.
Glacius and Magnus provide a great deal of light. Their frantic dance with our world almost guarantees the light of one, if not both, at all times.
His eyes linger for a long time on the faded outlines of each moon.
Their constant attention encouraged changes.
Evolution, Jamie says from the other side of the truck. Animals had to adapt. Speaker nods now.
More light meant more camouflage and poison among the smallest creatures,
heightened senses and strength among the largest. Inevitably, creatures were forced into relationships. If they work together over a number of generations, we call them forged.
The Erraticon, I say, thinking now. It had two sets of eyes.
Because it is two separate creatures, Speaker answers.
It's clear he's thinking hard about how to phrase what he wants to say next.
Nature has forced two skill sets to work in harmony. Often the change happens when a greater enemy enters their territory. The two work together so that they might survive.
Symbiotic relationships, Jamie says thoughtfully. That's kind of cool.
The Errata have notoriously vulnerable stomachs, Speaker explains. Once, they were easy to kill with a well-aimed spear. Their bond with the Akana offered a new protection. The body of an Akana is scaled, but it's also slow. The Errata offers speed and flight. The Akana offers defense. Together, the two have a better chance at survival.
Jamie shakes his head. Except when a century comes hunting.
Speaker's eyes widen. You saw a century?
We all nod, and he's so shocked that he actually covers his mouth. I can see the Nixian implant around his eye quivering with movement.
You are lucky to be alive.
It was huge, I say. What two animals make a century? He shakes his head.
Not two. One. A prime.
The word sends goosebumps down my arm. Prime?
There are 23 prime species. Predators that are dangerous enough to survive on their own. They rely on nothing but their own power or speed or ingenuity. They are the most dangerous creatures that exist in our world. Scientists have tracked their movements as often as possible. It's better for our people to simply avoid their migratory patterns.
Great, Jamie says. Glad we found one on our first night.
Speaker smiles. Fortunately, there are only two prime species in all of Grimgarden.
I nod. What's the other one?
We call ourselves the Imago.
We all stare for a second. And then Speaker throws back his head with wild laughter. It's so untamed and unexpected that we all laugh with him as our truck thunders over the hills.
Chapter 6. Dig. Emmett Atwater. Our first dig site is nestled in the southern corner of another sprawling plain. On the scouter map, it looks like a little claw dug into the underbelly of a forest that grows wider as it moves west. The ping on our map emits from a silver capsule that's plunged into the ground just outside the mining site. The chrome top of the buried device sits perfectly flush with the earth. There are a series of unmarked buttons and a glowing green dot to indicate the deposit on our radar. Speaker watches with fascination as the survey process begins. A dark cloud of drones sweeps out from beneath the truck, scanning the terrain all around us. As they work, digital imaging etches itself onto the captain's screen. Morning eyes the layout carefully, marking gas pockets and alternative routes into the heart of the mine. As I watch her work, I can tell that talking to Anton has lifted her spirits. Maybe they've got a plan brewing.
Okay, Morning announces. I'll run the show from the truck. When we get Nixie on the surface, I'll show everyone how we manipulate it for crating. Let's split up tasks.
Azima raises a hand.
I helped with the conveyor shaft.
Morning nods.
Anton will go with you. Follow his lead. We always set up two shafts. It's tricky, but if we do it right, we drain the mine twice as fast.
She glances between Jamie and me.
What about you two?
We both answer.
Jack, Jack.
Morning considers us.
I'd rather not have you in the drill right now, Jamie. Let's get that wound healed up first. You'll help manipulate the product in preparation for shipment. Emmett, you're on as the Jack Jack for now. Pull your weight or I'll bench you.
I raise an eyebrow.
Damn, Captain.
Captain is right, she says, smiling. Let's pit this peach.
It takes about 5 minutes to get the drill set up, 2 minutes to climb inside, and one more minute for my world to be reduced to jaw-jarring vibration. Voices squawk over the comm, but I'm too focused on the descent. 200 meters down into darkness. The drill tip bites into stone, spitting smoke and gutting a path to our collection point. On my monitor, Anton and Azima's progress on the conveyor shaft is marked by a thin, diagonal streak of blue. Morning buzzes directives, but right now, my only job is to dive and hold tight as my hands burn and blister, even with the protective gloves on. Gas pockets dance on the screen as we disturb the Nixian deposit. I realize it's probably never been touched before. It used to take Longway an hour to dive this far. Now I realize why. When his hands started to hurt, he would let go of the grips. Let go, and the drill keeps spinning, but it doesn't keep diving. In this, at least, I'm stronger than him. I hit my depth and Morning retracts the drill. The drill tracks with the weighted supports on the surface, gliding back up through the initial carnage of my dive. When I'm back up top, I pop the hatch so cool air can rush in. There's still too much heat flooding up from the hole for it to make much of a difference, though. Morning stands by the captain's console and flashes me a thumbs up. Speaker stands beside her, watching everything curiously. About 10 minutes later, I hear her voice pipe through the comm. Shafts are ready. You're on again, Emmett. I slip back into the cockpit. A second later, the two side drills extend. One drill had the world rattling. Two feels like earthquakes inside earthquakes. I adjust my grips on the silver joysticks, and metal whirs as my chair leans back, my legs extending. Silver foot panels blink with light, and I punch my feet against them. Darkness devours the windows as I reach my first depth. The drills hiss and catch on the Nixian walls, ragdolling me until they find a balance. Nixia shatters, tumbling down the first shaft and into the collection area. The pulses light up, and I strike into the heart of the rock. I can't help smiling, because this still feels like a video game that I'm pretty damn good at. My steady work keeps Nixia raining down in constant streams. The drill is 50 meters deep when the screen flashes its first warning. Red circles churn along the edges of my tunnel. Gas pockets. See that, Morning? I ask. You're fine, she says. Keep both drills rolling. I miss a few pulses as I stare at the red discoloration. I only blew up twice in simulations, but one time will do the trick in real life. Who are you going to boss around if I explode? Someone else, I guess, she says, and I can almost see the smirk. Just trust me. I do trust her. The drill digs down. 10 meters. 5 meters. I give the wall right above it a good pulse, grip my teeth as rock rains, and watch the red blotches flutter on my screen. I brace myself, but the gas retreats, finding deeper spaces between the stones. I let out a ragged breath and keep things moving. Morning's laugh sounds in my ear. You really think I'm bossy? Oh, the worst, I say, smiling. Anton adds, I've always seen you as a female version of Napoleon. Too tall, Jamie disagrees. Morning actually groans. Not to mention he was a tyrant, Anton. At least make me a hero from Mexican history, like one of the Adelitas or something. She should be compared to a queen, Azima pipes in, like Cleopatra. Actually, I'd take Cleopatra, Morning replies. Everyone laughs at that. 3 hours later, I'm bone tired, but the mine's done. I admire the rows and rows of manipulated Nixia stacked in the truck bed. I don't even want to guess how many millions of dollars it translates into. My boots are puddled with sweat, and my hands are hating me. Morning calls us all out to clean up and find a place to go for a swim. She pulls aside speaker first, though. Are we okay to wash up, or is it too dangerous?
We prepared for your coming, speaker replies.
Hunting parties were sent through the areas between your established bases. We thinned out the more dangerous species, or at least forced their migratory patterns elsewhere.
So it's safe?
Morning asks. Safe enough, Speaker replies. The nearest creek isn't large enough for our most dangerous breeds either. I believe you will be fine.
Morning pings the creek in question, and we all head out. It's a brave new world, but the boys head over one hill as the girls go down another. Speaker stands awkwardly back by the truck. The Imago probably didn't give him any protocol for how to handle bath time. We strip down to underwear and splash around a creek that's barely knee-high. I've never felt anything so good in my life. Long after I've washed the grime from my face and hands, I lie belly up, staring at clouds that remind me so much of home, it hurts. Anton gargles water and sprays it out like a fountain statue. Jamie sits off to one side, hair slicked back and pale shoulders hunched. The scene looks so normal, so human. It's almost enough to forget that each of us was asked to kill someone just 48 hours ago. One look at Jamie or Anton is enough to see the truth. Babel's betrayal isn't done digging under our skin. Maybe it's a good thing, I think. Maybe resistance will be easier. Babel's shown us too many of their cards to pretend they're something else now. Jamie runs a hand over the water. We've been quiet for a while, but I can tell he's working up the courage to say something. This is the first time I've really looked at him since landing. It's easy to forget how close he was to dying. He hasn't forgotten.
I hate them, he finally says. I really hate them.
I exchange a glance with Anton.
Yeah, I answer. Me too. Anton just leans back in the water and points a middle finger skyward. Jamie squints up through the clouds like he can actually see the station orbiting. Anger fills his voice.
It's not fair. They set the rules and I followed the rules and I won. That should have been the end of it. It wasn't fair that they put Brett in the room with me and...
As he talks, his hands ball into fists.
I haven't been able to sleep. They broke their promise and made me a murderer. None of it is fair. And now... I'm going to do everything I can to bury them.
He glances back at us nervously, like maybe he sounds extreme. But Anton stands up and slaps Jamie's bare shoulder with affection.
I was worried before, he says. I thought you were just another broken boy we needed to look after. But you're not. You're a weapon. Babel put you through the fire and you survived. They shouldn't have made us this way. They'll regret how sharp we are now that we're aimed at them.
Anton offers a hand to help Jamie up. The three of us walk back to the truck, and Anton's words echo and build, louder and louder, until they're in my chest like a song. We're weapons. They made us this way. And we're coming for them. Chapter 7 Orbiting. Emmett Atwater. Morning keeps us moving. We pack up the dig site, load our truck back up, and leave behind a crater. Looking down into the gaping cavern, I feel a little sick to my stomach. We've been on the Imago's planet for 24 hours, and we're already shredding it. But this is our plan. We're going to go from one site to the next, gathering enough Nixia to send back to Babel as we wait out their next move. It feels wrong, really, to just accept their next betrayal. There's just not much we can do besides play nice until we figure out our options. I glance back at the loaded stacks of Nixia and remember Defoe's presentation at our first meeting.
Each of those black dots is worth somewhere in the realm of $2 billion.
Each mine, worth billions. The idea of that much money is disorienting. We move on to the second mine, and it's a nightmare. Arrival time gives us about 3 hours to work. Gas pockets are shifting so much beneath the surface, though, that the computer system can't even find a good origin point. Morning maps out the movements for 30 minutes before picking a proper setup.
One of the conveyor tunnels collapses on our first attempt, so Anton and Azima end up moving the rover to the opposite side and starting over. There's an hour's worth of delays as we wait for the underground shifting of gas to stop. Time feels like it's moving slower than the sweat on my visor. Speaker noted our efficiency on the first mine. I wonder if he's monitoring our failures during the second.
All right, Morning calls. You clear for now, Emmett. I'm going to go down the conveyor shaft to fix a jammed line. Jamie's got eyes on you, all right?
Got it,
I say, firing the drill up again. We've only sheared away 3 or 4 meters from the main shaft. I haven't built a rhythm at all today, so I miss pulses and feel groggy the deeper I go. Jamie calls out another pressure shift, and I kill the drill, frustrated and sweating. I'm about to vent my frustrations when an explosion tears through the underground. A deep grumbling follows. I hear a single, violent shriek through the comm. Rocks shift all around me. My eyes dart to the scanner, the windows. I've got no visuals at all.
What the hell was that? I ask. Is everyone all right?
Jamie responds from up top.
Conveyor shaft collapsed again.
Then Anton is shouting.
Morning! Are you there, Morning?
There's no response. Only Anton's heavy breathing, a grunt.
She was in there!
Anton shouts.
Jamie, can you see anything on the screen?
We're all asterisks on the computer. Panicking, I make the count. 4. Only 4 of us.
Negative,
Jamie answers.
Right before it happened, her asterisk vanished.
Shit,
Anton says.
Get over here now!
I have no idea what's going on above, but I can see the comet streak of our conveyor shafts on the screen. I'm about 50 meters above the end of the tunnel. On the screen, it looks like a black claw has slashed the shaft in two. Morning's in there somewhere. There is nothing to think about. There was no decision to make. There was only my body moving toward hers. I unstrap from my chair. In a side compartment of the drill casing, I find the emergency supplies. Rope, oxygen tanks, and a ton of gauze. I attach everything to my suit's utility belt and hook the rope carabiner to the top of the drill. We all learn this in the simulator, but it takes a few extra seconds to make my nervous hands repeat the steps I practiced. I hook the rope under my arms and around my waist, cinch it tight, and give a tug. It holds. Slowly, I lower myself over the lip of the drill. I avoid the extended claws, knowing they'd burn through suit and skin with a touch. Down into heat, into the hole I've been carving for hours, darkness swallows me. I flick on my shoulder light, and a bright beam spotlights the wall. I take it slow, knowing a fall and a broken neck won't help Morning. Voices pipe through as I descend. A curse from Anton, a question from Azima, every word colored with fear. Morning had us download digital reads of the mine before we started. Blinking, I pull up the map on my scouter. I've lowered myself just above the conveyor shaft, but I still can't see the mouth of the tunnel. Below, Nixia glitters in chaotic piles. Another meter, and my feet find empty air. Reaching down, I trace the lip of the conveyor shaft with a hand. It takes a little twist to lower myself inside. I detach the rope, and my shoulder light flashes up an undisturbed tunnel. God, it's small. Hardly big enough to walk down. I crouch forward, heat knifing through my suit and turning my stomach. Red spots leap across my vision. The map shows gas pockets gathering in the second shaft, some 10 meters beneath my hands and knees. I steady my breathing and keep crawling forward. Morning is the only thought in my head. I have to find Morning. Finally, the light lands on shattered rocks, charred air, and twisted stone. I shovel what I can behind me and come to the largest pile of Nixian rubble, all strewn around a dark form.
Emmett!
Jamie's voice sounds over the comm.
You've got red sneaking up on you?
Copy that.
My hands dig frantically at the stones. Even with my suit and triple-thick gloves, it's like plucking pieces of meat from a sizzling grill with bare hands. I'm halfway to the dark bulge beneath the rocks when Jamie pipes in again.
We've moved too much down there,
he says.
It's going to release. I'm pulling the drill.
I grunt, knowing my rope will get pulled with it, knowing it's too late to crawl back that direction anyway. The only way out now is forward. Gritting my teeth, I slide rocks away until I've unearthed a dark sphere of stone. I crouch over it. It isn't a shard like the rest. It's smooth as a tomb, and cold as a creek. I lower a shoulder, trying to wedge it out. Nothing happens. I glance back down the tunnel and hear a click. The massive sphere unfolds in circular strips, peeling away from the center like an orange. The dark casing slides back, and morning smiles out at me.
"You came for me," she says. "You shouldn't have."
Relief thunders in my chest.
"You're alive."
She takes my hand and crawls out of the shell. With a manipulation, she draws the protective cocoon back into the form of her Nixian jacket. She must have thrown it over herself just before the tunnel collapsed. We're still trapped between a rock pile and the creeping gases behind us, though. On my scouter, red dots are blossoming. I think back to all the times I died in the simulations. We have less than 2 minutes. You have a plan, right? Morning flips on her comm. Retract the drill, move the truck, everyone out of the tunnels. We're coming up. She turns her attention to the pile of Nixia. These pieces are all shattered, so it's not one big piece anymore, right? I stare at the pile. We don't have time to manipulate all of them.
No,
Morning says. Not even close. But we can do all the loosened pieces at once. My panic doubles.
That's not possible.
Do you trust me? She asks. Red curls to life in my readout, fighting for open air. Pressure will release, and pretty soon it won't matter whether I trust her or not.
Let's do it.
All right. It's like what we did on the waterway ships. You would feed Longway energy, right? Add your strength to his to move faster? She waits for me to nod.
It's kind of like that, but we're going to make a circle. I'm pushing energy to you as you push it to me. I'm receiving energy from you as you receive it from me. Make sense?
Yeah, I got it. And then what?
Once we have it moving, she says, we'll take on the pile of stones. Imagine dust.
Morning digs through the pile and finds the largest chunk she can. She sets it between us and meets my eyes. The stone resists my first grasping effort. I take a breath, focus my mind, and reach for it again. Our connection clicks to life. I can feel Morning across the Nixian link. Slowly, I start to push some of my energy forward, through the stone, in her direction. It's answered immediately on her end. She's pushing energy to me, and I can feel it pulsing. The hairs on the back of my neck rise as a circle starts to form. Push and pull. Energy that's moving in a constant circle and gaining momentum. It's a use of Nixia I never learned aboard Genesis 11. It takes about 10 seconds to establish a rhythm, churning in the air around us. It almost feels like the power is orbiting us, forming a new center of gravity. Morning nods toward the pile and we turn, our steps in perfect harmony. I think about Defoe showing off on the ship. The way he manipulated the massive slab of Nixia into squares and cylinders and pyramids. So quick, it looked like child's play. I know the pile in front of us is 5 times bigger and full of shattered, shapeless pieces. An impossibility. But as the energy turning between us reaches a peak, I know we're strong enough.
You guys need to get out now!
Jamie pipes through the comm. As one, we reach out. Our feet dig into matching stances. Even her breathing is completely in tune with mine. One breath. 2 breaths. 3. We begin. The force inside all that Nixia almost takes control. It's more powerful than anything I ever felt on the ship. Dark faces come rushing forward. A strength that smacks into us like the warning wave of a tsunami. But together we stand our ground. We shoulder back the grasping hands in the substance, and our power cracks like a whip. My eyesight flickers as every piece blocking our path grinds, shudders, and pulverizes. Dust fills the shaft, and it's only sheer luck that we stumble toward one another. My remaining energy is a thin, dying thing. Morning is smaller than me, more staggered by the weight of all that power. I catch her arm and drape it over one shoulder. Hold your breath. We stumble forward like firemen. Coughing and blinded, I force a path through the slanting shafts of falling powder and dust. Our efforts almost run us right into Anton.
How the hell did you do that?
He asks. All that Nyxia just crumbled to dust.
Get her other side, I shout. We have to get out.
He snakes past us and adds his strength to mine. We lurch forward, crouched and tripping over ourselves. Speaker stands guard at the entrance. He moves aside as we pour out, falling into the dirt and taking great gasps of fresh air. Behind us, explosions rip through the ground. I turn in time to see Speaker manipulating Nyxia, sealing both conveyor shafts. Everything shakes and quivers. Jamie's driving the truck toward us. Behind him, we see a snaking tongue of fire sear the air. It almost looks fake, a Hollywood explosion. Black smoke circles everything. Wind disfigures the perfect edges. We watch dark shapes writhe in the air. No one says anything for a long time. It's Speaker who finally breaks the silence.
I'm starting to believe your species lives more exciting lives than ours.
Even morning laughs as smoke colors the sky. Chapter 8. Surprises and Mistakes. Emmett Atwater. Everyone is eager to pack up and head back to Foundry after that. As we do, Morning comes up with 7 new procedural rules for mining the shafts, even though she's the only one who was breaking them in the first place. She laughs and leads us like nothing happened. Maybe I'm the only one who can see the change. There's a gentleness she offers only to me. I've seen this side of her before, but only in glimpses. A shared song as we look down on Magnia for the first time. The quiet whispers before we fell asleep in her room. The hug she gave me after landing safely. But something about the way she looks at me now feels more permanent. It fills me with a light that I thought Babel took from me. It's the first sign on a long road back to something good. As our truck cruises through foreign valleys, all full of fading light, I can almost feel Bilal's and Kaya's spirits urging me to hold on to this first ray of hope. Kit greets us at the edge of Foundry. We climb out of the truck and circle to the back as he counts the payload.
How'd we do? Anton asks. Were we good boys and girls today?
Pulled more than the other crews,
Kit says, still scanning the rows with his enhanced glove.
Longway will be pissed. He's been hounding me about the totals. I keep telling him there's not a scoreboard down here, but he won't listen. I'm surprised by your numbers, though. This is a lot of Nyxia to pull from just one mine.
That's because we pitted 2, Anton replies. Try and keep up, rookie.
Kit raises one eyebrow.
Impressive. I'll take it from here. The truck will get retooled and you'll be ready to roll tomorrow morning. We're setting a great pace.
I can't help but notice the word we. Kit really thinks we're all one pristine unit, working together for some common Babel good. He thinks this is actually our team of choice.
When will you send up the first shipment of Nyxia?
Anton asks. Kit's scrolling through an interface, eyeing numbers in some kind of spreadsheet. Morning flashes Anton a quick look. He returns it with a calm, I've got this gesture. Thankfully, Kit's too distracted to notice the exchange.
Maybe day 5?
Kit replies.
The silo has to reach capacity before we send up a shipment. But I can't wait to hit the launch button. It's like science class on steroids.
Anton just nods like he's not really that interested. I catch another look between him and Morning. But when I raise an eyebrow, Morning just shakes her head. I feel a little flash of jealousy. I want to be in on the plan. I want to be her go-to. But at least they have a plan. Deep down, I know she's just being smart, not wanting to risk letting Babel in on the secret. The sun's almost set, and Foundry's lights have flickered on. Overhead, the 2 moons have rotated slightly. I trace the red veins on Magnus's surface, trying to memorize their pattern.
You must excuse me, Speaker says. The interstellar contract asks that we stay outside the boundaries of the base. I must join my brothers, but I look forward to more time with you.
Azima waves back. Jamie offers a little salute. I nod his way. Take it easy, Speak. He smiles at the nickname before heading out.
Morning drifts to my side as the whole group approaches Foundry's open entryway. Her voice isn't louder than a whisper.
Remember to be careful. Isadora isn't going to forget about you.